Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we'll go inside yesterday's crowd at St. Peter's Square in Rome as the new Pope was announced and what the desert taught Frank Lloyd Wright. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
We don't think that it was just good policy to be mailing out people because you just can't predict how people are going to behave and act, and we're not mind readers. So it's important for us to make sure that we're taking care of ballots and being secure with them.
To have families book a hotel room, not realizing the large percentage of potentially dangerous people to them and their children are in this facility, is criminal.
Today, we mark a meaningful step forward in our shared duty to protect Arizona's students, not with rhetoric, but with real reform.
Veterans make up more than 30% of the federal workforce, and it is now estimated that Donald Trump and his administration has already fired more than 6,000 men and women who have served in uniform.
We need a person who generates confidence in the party. It's the job of the party to promote our candidates. It's the job of the chair to raise money for our candidates and to promote our candidates.
SB 1268 undermines the core role of hospitals as places of healing by turning them into de facto immigration enforcement agents.
And joining me to talk about a difference of opinion between the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors and County Recorder, a seeming difference of strategic opinion between the Trump team and a gubernatorial candidate and more, are Doug Cole of High Ground. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Mark.
And Democratic strategist Tony Connie. Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Doug, let's start with a report that came out this week from Axios that there were some Trump campaign officials who had been working either officially or unofficially with the Karen Taylor Robeson campaign. They apparently have decided that she was not advertising on TV early enough after the president endorsed her and have decided that they are no longer part of the campaign. Assuming that this reporting is correct and we don't have any reason to think that it's not, how big of a deal could that be for Karen Taylor Robeson and her campaign?
Well, we all could see this coming a long time ago. I mean, the Trump organization has a history of doing double endorsements. We saw that with Blake Masters and Abe Hamadeh to replace Congresswoman Debbie Lesko out in CD8. In politics, it becomes an industry, especially if you have someone that's a president or a governor, and then their political consultants then use that to go out and bring more into the fold. And to be honest, because I'm a political consultant, to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened here. Trump endorsed Karen Taylor Robeson early on, but most people thought, okay. As soon as the budget deal was made in Congress, why did Andy Biggs change his vote, right? All of a sudden, he's on the budget. So I think this is an excuse to move away and have these folks move over to the Biggs campaign. Is it a temporary setback for Karen Taylor Robeson? Yes, but it's not fatal, in my opinion.
Does this, do you think, precede the president rescinding his endorsement?
I don't think he will do that because of the makeup of Arizona. He needs the business community, and he needs the portion of the Arizona Republican Party, like myself, that's not raised or practices in the mega world, but is a cradle Republican, and we are Republicans are still the biggest voting base in the mm-hmm. state, etc. So if I was Karen Taylor Robeson, a lot of people don't know Andy Biggs. I mean, he's well-known in the East Valley. He's well-known in his congressional district. He only had one really hard race, and that was his first primary where he only beat Christine Jones by, I think it was 9 votes, something.
A very small margin. Yeah.
After many recounts. So he really hasn't been tested statewide. And I would, if I was Karen Taylor Robeson, I would take my money and start defining who Andy Biggs is, because we all know who she is because she – spent a lot of money running against Carrie Lake. She's already spent a lot of money in here recently. I would start defining who Andy Biggs is and talk about issues that Arizonans care about.
Tony, how big of a deal is this, do you think, to her campaign to lose members of Trump's team?
I'm sure she didn't want it to happen. And, I do think it is true that it almost looks like there was a commitment that was made to do some sort of advertising that would have included Trump, which was good for Trump if his face is up on TV. And then once that finally happened, even though they said it was later than it was, these consultants sort of just cut bait and left. And so maybe they got their check. Who knows? But
I'm sure they got their check.
Yeah, I'm sure they got their check. I mean, look, here's the thing about like the finding bigs and all this kind of stuff. Like, how's Robeson going to do that? There really isn't a ton of room ideologically between the two of them. They have some differences on things. But she has not demonstrated a willingness to stand up to the Republican or MAGA establishment. And what's going to happen? She's going to attack him for being against Medicaid? There's no way she would do that. So, I think this is a huge setback for her, just because I think that they were very excited that they were able to get that initial endorsement. And obviously, I think what's going to happen now is she's going to continue to use or start to use her wealth to just tell voters over and over again, hey, I'm the one that was endorsed by Trump. And we'll see whether or not money rolls in on the other side to support Biggs. I think that the issue here is that she does have a bit of an authenticity problem when it comes to voters. That's what happened last time. And I don't know how this helps her overcome that.
Well, I hate to disagree with my friend Tony.
But you'll do it anyway.
I'm going to do it anyway. On the Medicaid issue, I think Congressman Juan Ciscomani's done a very good job about messaging, really, really threading the needle on the Medicaid. There's a group of Republicans in the House that has really said, wait a minute here. These are important programs, especially for a border state like Arizona. So, yeah, I think there's a good message point to go after Congressman Biggs on Medicaid. And because there's a huge constituency in the Republican Party that uses Medicaid.
Sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, yes, I think so. I just am not sure that like Trump is going to be this strategic in thinking about how he needs to get the moderate business Republicans in Arizona. This doesn't seem to be the way that he's making decisions on endorsements. I think it probably he's not going to unendorse because that would be admitting he made some sort of a mistake. But look, I there's no doubt about the fact that her campaign would have preferred if she would have stayed the sole endorser.
I don't disagree.
Yeah,
sure.
On that point.
All right. So, Doug, you'd mentioned then Congresswoman Debbie Lesko, now, of course, a member of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, who is having a bit of a kerfuffle with the Maricopa County recorder, Justin Heap, over the administration of this summer's special congressional election. This is, of course, the election to replace the late Raul Grijalva. Maricopa County is just a very small part of that district. It's mostly Pima County and southern and even into western Arizona.
Right. Santa Cruz County.
Santa Cruz County, right. But there's some questions about whether or not voters who are on the active early voting list, I think is what it's called now, like who should get ballots. And it seems as though Recorder Heap is proposing a plan that maybe when he was in the legislature, he would not have been a big fan of.
Well, that's exactly correct. What he proposed to the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, and they voted 4-0 against him when the supervisors wasn't there that day. So it's not just Debbie Lesko. Three of her other colleagues also agreed with her. This was offered in a presentation to the board by Sam Stone, who is
the chief of staff.
The chief of staff to Recorder Heap that in these very rural precincts that are out in the far reaches of Gila Bend, et cetera, out on the Tohono Nation lands, that they would just go ahead and mail the ballots to the registered voters, whether they request them or not. Now, this is completely antithetical to what happened in what the Republicans fought then Maricopa County Recorder, who now Secretary of State Adrian Fontes. He wanted to do that during the pandemic to mail ballots to all voters during that time, and the courts turned him down because what the court said, and now also has County Attorney Rachel Mitchell in a letter to Justin Heap said, look, on election law, you have to explicitly be authorized to do an action. And mailing ballots to people that have not requested them in a congressional race is not explicitly allowed. Okay, it is in school district races. It is in city and town races and special taxing districts, but not in other elections. So she said, no, you can't do that. This is unlawful. So the board said, we're not doing that.
How surprising is it that the County Board of Supervisors, which is, of course, as it has been for many years, controlled by Republicans, is having this kind of disagreement with a Republican county recorder?
Well, unfortunately, the history since the Andy Thomas days and the Joe Arpaio days, there's been a lot of disagreements between the County Board of Supervisors, who controls all their budgets and sets county policy, and various elected row officers. And unfortunately, this is continuing with Justin Heap being the new Maricopa County Recorder.
Tony, what do we make of the fact? I mean, this is a very Democratic-leaning district, the late Raul Grijalva's district. So really, the primary is kind of where the action is. But, like, are you surprised that there's this kind a disagreement of this nature over something that in the past Republicans have generally been pretty unified against sending ballots to voters who did not ask for them?
I'm not surprised that the fight is happening, because this is just another example of the sort of fighting the Republican Party along the MAGA Turning Point USA line, right? And this is what's happening. And, you know, from my outside perspective, it looks like he sort of stepped in this from a political perspective on the Republican side, and the county supervisors, who are probably very frustrated and fed up with the way that they've been interacting with them, just decided to pounce. And, you know, from a policy perspective, I want voting to be as easy as possible. I want it to be I want the administration of election to be as cheap as possible. I think I was surprised that this decision was made, because first of all, it's a Democratic district. And, you know, when Fontes made his suggestion, it was something that would have happened to all voters. This is just to a specific type of voter.
And not that many of them.
And not that many.
It's like 100 or so.
It made me wonder, you know, like, what is their motivation? And with the history of wanting to sort of like pull people off the voter rolls and do all these kind of things that, you know, the Turning Point USA people have pushed for, I was like, is this some sort of a trick to get people to fall off of, you know, the active voter list? Like, is there something that they're doing here? It really raised red flags for me, because I just couldn't figure out why they would do this. The issue I think that is the most concerning from the outside is that Sam Stone and Recorder Heap implied that they had gotten sign off from the county attorney, and the county attorney was like, that's not true. And so there's some shenanigans going on.
Yeah, and I also think, I know we started the segment talking about Supervisor, former Congresswoman Lesko. Immediately, Gina Silvota, who is the chairwoman of the Arizona Republican Party, said, I don't agree. The party does not agree with the county recorder. We are for election integrity, and this is not election integrity in our mind. So she immediately took the supervisor's side.
Well, and Tony, this is not the first sort of disagreement, let's say, between the county supervisors and the county recorder. This is obviously a very small, for Maricopa County, this election, you know, kind of small potatoes in terms of number of voters, the responsibility it has. But, I mean, we're not that far off from the midterms next year. It seems as though these two levels of government need to kind of get it together.
Yeah, it would be great if they got it together. But this is this fight's been going on, and it's gotten aggressive, and people have, you know, chimed in aggressive ways against the supervisors, against the recorder. And I think, you know, from my perspective, I love the mess here between elected officials. This is a fight over ideology, really, you know, in perspective, you know, but I really would like our elections to be drama free.
Yeah.
When it comes to administration. So I do hope that they figure it out.
Tony, some more drama within the state Democratic Party this week. We started the week with a letter from one of the precinct committee leaders in the Democratic Party calling on the new chair of the party, Robert Branscombe, to resign. This, of course, follows some pretty significant back and forth between some of the top elected Democratic officials in the state, saying that Branscombe has lost their trust. He was saying that he was having some trouble with them. Like, what's going on with the Arizona Democrats right now?
I think there's a lot of people who have lost trust in the chair, and I think that's what it is, and you're seeing it here. And look, people who have been involved in party politics know that there's often disagreements, that this stuff happens. I think that there are people who are frustrated that the chair's sort of lack of judgment, in my perspective, to take a disagreement that he had and go straight to the media with it originally. And, you know, I— there's near unanimity right now that people are concerned about his chairmanship. You know, you've got all the statewide elected officials on the Democratic side who've expressed concerns. You have, you know, I think 10 of the county chairs have expressed some concerns with the process. And, you know, and there's some real issues here. And you know, and I think the difference between this and some of the other fights is this isn't about ideology. This isn't some there's one camp of people versus another camp of people based on things they want to accomplish. Mm-hmm. This is really about trust, and it's about competence. And, you know, the big news this week also was that the state party's one of their big fundraising dinners, the Washington Post reported that they canceled it because there were only 11 RSVPs, which it says I saw that and I was like, did I get invited? And I didn't get invited. And it speaks to sort of this competence thing where it's like, oh, I guess they just didn't invite people to it. So what's happening is people are really putting pressure on him to either fix things or to step down. And you know, I don't think this is going to be a huge devastating blow for the Democratic Party. I wish we didn't have to deal with this right now.
Yeah.
But it is there, you know, people really do agree. I mean, like they're spending more money than they're raising right now. That's not, you know, that's not the way it should be at the party this time of year.
So do you think he ultimately steps down, or do you think he's able to fix it to the satisfaction of some of those elected Democrats, many of whom are on the ballot next year?
Yeah. And these are the people who have raised the most money for the Democrats in the history of our state. And so like the statewide, they know what they're doing, and they had been working with him in a weekly basis. He said on your show, he was, you know, before all this mm-hmm. blew down, about how there's unity. And I was watching this from the outside being like, you know what? That's not the guy they wanted to be chair, but they're weeding every week. They're all, you know, and that's the thing that hadn't been happening. So I was really optimistic. So I was really disappointed when this thing blew up. But I think that there will be some sort of a resolution. And if there isn't, you know, there's other options here where, you know, the statewide elected officials and everybody can come together and do what the Republican Party did a number of years ago and just run a lot of their operations through a county party or something. And so, look, this is frustrating, but I'm not too worried about it. I'm annoyed about it. And I do hope that he is starting to listen to the large number of people who are asking him to either step down or to change.
Doug, do you think Democrats should be worried?
Well, you know, I'm sitting here listening to Tony, and this is deja vu all over again. All I had to do go back, and the same conversation was going on in these very chairs in front of these very microphones about the Republican Party a few years back when Kelly Ward was running that ship, and it was all about her, and it was all about promoting what she wanted to do and her ego and spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on election night parties and fundraisers going bad. And as Tony alluded to, then a lot of the business folks in our party went to the Yuma County Party and ran their own fundraising operations and campaign operations through that and worked around her. So, yeah, you know, being a party chair is a tough job. And I think Gina Svoboda has stabilized our party and has done a good job of bringing folks together. I know she's getting attacked by some quarters from Turning Point Action and others over there, but she's holding her own. The Republican Party's had a history of having these type of problems that is now going on in the Democratic Party. And I think it's just inherent of being a party chair. This is not unique in Arizona. It's a tough, tough job because everybody that's a member of these parties, the activists, they have their own idea about what the party's direction ought to be. And sometimes it doesn't gel with everybody. And there's always fighting going on, and there's always bickering going on, and rules being challenged, et cetera. It's a tough job. So So my hat's off to those that put themselves out for it. But this is going to continue to happen, and we'll continue to talk about this 5 years from now. It'll be the Democrat or back to the Republicans next time. I don't know.
And, you know, and the interesting thing about this is that, like, the activist side of the party, the people who – there are people who voted for him, who supported him, who are raising concerns about this. I think that, you know, when we're talking about infighting, it's becoming more like people are frustrated with a person, maybe two people. And so – there is some unity around the fact that maybe there needs to be a change here. And so, you know, we'll see. He's going to be under a lot of pressure at the upcoming state committee meeting.
I wonder, though, if you're going to have this kind of thing happen, is it better for it to happen in the Democrats' case in 2025 than in 2026?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
100%.
So,
I mean, Tony, do you think this affects next year's races at all? I mean, it would seem as though there's got to be some pressure to get this sorted out before too much longer.
Yeah, I think that it will be more difficult from there. There'll be work that we'll have to accomplish if he doesn't fix things or step down. But I think in the end, with the number of people who are raising concerns, if they'll just move to somewhere else. And I think that, you know, the people are going to still be raising money. And, you know, so I'm not too worried about it.
Yeah, the top of the ticket's going to be Katie Hobbs, right? And mm-hmm. she's already raising a lot of
money.
Ton of money, doing very well on that front. And I think we don't have a senatorial race next year for the first time.
First time in forever.
Forever, because we had all these appointments and such. So that's going to be the focus race. And you know, you always look to the top. But you need, on the down ballot races, you really need a strong party organization to help those candidates.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if in some ways, and we talked about this, Doug, I think, when all this was going down with the state Republican Party, if all of this kind of gets to the idea of maybe the party's not carrying the same weight or having the same import now as they have in years past with the, you know, the invention of super PACs and maybe going to county parties and the ability of other groups to raise money and message, you know, for candidates. Tony, do you think that this in some way maybe just sort of hastens the I don't want to say the demise, but the less relevance of state parties?
Well, I don't think it will, because at least on the Democratic side, we've been very good at running what we call a coordinated campaign, which is where everybody comes together to run a campaign up and down the ballot, mm-hmm. right? And that typically is run through the state party, and that is the preference, is to go back and to be able to do that through the state through the state party. So, you know, I think that people will want the state party to be the entity that is being used for that. But I mean, geez, I with everybody really is raising some alarms here. I mean, the staff union wrote a letter saying they were concerned about some of the things that he said. I just think there's going to be a lot of pressure, you know, for him to step down.
Yeah, and running coordinated campaigns has also been very successful on the Republican side, because you get preferential rates on mail, mm-hmm. It just makes things a lot cheaper, and you can touch more voters.
Interesting. All right, guys, we're going to have to leave it there. Doug Cole, Tony Connie, thanks you both for coming in. Thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the Sonoran Desert's influence on Frank Lloyd Wright and what it can teach us about sustainable design. But first, St. Peter's Square in Rome was packed yesterday in anticipation of the announcement of a new pope. And when Pope Leo XIV walked out onto the balcony, that crowd got its first view of the new pontiff, the first American pope. Sarah Ventry, NPR senior producer of religion, was in the square yesterday and joins me to talk about what it was like there. And Sarah, at what point did you realize there was actually white smoke coming out of that chimney?
Well, so everybody was gathering and waiting, and we kind of knew around what time we might be able to expect it. But like the vote the night before had taken a really long time. So we sort of expected it at one time, and it didn't come out. The black smoke didn't come out till like 2 hours later. So everybody was sort of gathered in the square in anticipation. And I think that they were like, okay, we should see something. But there was like a lot of waiting around. So, you know, there was like a kid in front of me who was talking to a priest, and, you know, there were like families and all kinds of people, and everybody was just sort of like chatting and stuff. And then all of a sudden, you could hear the crowd kind of like swell up as the white smoke started to plume. And so as soon as I heard that crowd swell, I just looked up and saw all of this smoke coming from the chimney. And there were these like giant screens in the square where they showed a close-up of that chimney too. And people just completely erupted.
Well, so there must have been such anticipation both leading up to that moment, but then once everyone saw the white smoke, knowing that within some amount of time we would know who the new pope was, what was that sort of waiting period like to see who this person was going to be?
So the day before, I had talked to a woman in the square who had said she described the mood as having a kind of quiet anticipation. Mm. And I think once the white smoke came, it was no longer quiet. So at that point, everybody, you know, there were tens of thousands of people there. And once the white smoke came, more people started to come and people started to pack in tighter. So if you imagine being at like, you know, a giant sporting event or like a New Year's Eve party outside or something like that, that, like, everybody just kind of started crunching closer and closer together, and you could really feel like people are packing in, people are, like, you know, asking questions, they were taking photos, they were, like, you know, everybody was just, like, super, super, like, on the edge of their seat, on the edge of their toes, I guess, everybody's standing.
Yeah.
So I think, like, in between when the white smoke came and when we heard the pronouncement and who the new Pope was, you could just sort of feel this extra electricity in the crowd.
What kinds of things were people saying? You mentioned a lot of people were asking questions, like, what kind of things were people talking about?
Well, I mean, a lot of people were like, who do you think it is? I mean, going into this conclave, there was a really open field of possible. So the word is papabile, which literally means popable. So going into a conclave, there's sort of cardinals that people think of as being, you know, potential front runners for the papal seat, and they call them papabili. So there were a lot of papabili this time because Francis had appointed so many cardinals himself, and so there was a sense that, like, a lot of these cardinals are new, they don't know each other, who knows what it could be. And so there was sort of a feeling like, for example, when Pope Francis was named, people were like, wait, who is this guy? Like, he was sort of a dark horse that nobody expected. And there was definitely a sense that, like, this could be another dark horse and we don't really know who it's going to be. So people, I think, were really like, I heard two nuns asking each other, I think in Spanish, like, do you know, who do you think it's going to be? I don't know who it's going to be. So it was just like a lot of that kind of anticipation.
Well, so watching the coverage of it here in the newsroom, somebody commented that it almost looked like a World Cup match because there were so many people with different countries' flags flying in St. Peter's Square. What was the mood like? What was the feeling like when we realized who the new Pope was going to be and that it was somebody from the United States?
So I think that's something that truly almost no one could have predicted. I mean, it was really, really shocking. There's kind of a moment that you could hear in the crowd. They announced the name. When it was announced that it was Cardinal Prevost, you could hear people sort of processing it. Like, you could hear them kind of being a little bit surprised and unsure. And you kind of hear her to, like, oh, kind of like come over the whole crowd. And people were, like, really not expecting that. I mean, and because it is such an important event to so many people across the world, you know, there are 1.4 billion Catholics across the globe. And there were people there from all over the world speaking all different languages. So I think even Americans were not expecting it to be an American Pope. And also this year, there were so many new cardinals from different parts of the world that have not really had a lot of representation in the College of Cardinals before. There was a lot of conversation that maybe this year we could have expected a cardinal from the Global South. So I think there was just sort of like a surprise. And then I immediately saw people starting to Google his name. And there was really almost no cell service in the square. But people were like, wait a second, who is this guy?
That is so interesting. And you mentioned all different languages. You must have heard so many different languages just standing in that square.
Absolutely, I did. I mean, I heard people speaking languages I recognized. I heard people speaking languages I didn't recognize. There were pilgrims from all over the world. You know, there were clergy, there was laity, there were faithful, there were Catholics, there were non-Catholics, secular people. I even met one woman who just happened to be visiting from India. She said, I'm Hindu, but this moment is so overwhelming and special, and I just really wanted to be here for it. So I think, like, it is a moment that feels really important and special and unique, and really so many people in the world are watching, whether they're Catholic or not.
Yeah, interesting. All right. That is Sarah Ventry, NPR senior producer of Religion in Rome. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark.
Christopher Rivas is a playwright, author, podcaster, and actor. In his memoir, Brown Enough, which he subsequently turned into a podcast, he explores the performative nature of race, gender, and American identity. His theater work often mines similar territory. Earlier this year, he wrote and performed a play called The Real James Bond Was Dominican, which blends Rivas' personal history with the story of Porfirio Rubirosa, a real-life diplomat, race car driver, and spy whose biography Ian Fleming mined when he created the character of 007. Rivas is spending this year as an artist in residence at ASU Gamage, developing another theater piece called How to Get Free. As he recently told my co-host Sam Dingman, the production is inspired in part by three Greek myths, Narcissus, Tantalus, and Sisyphus.
Sisyphus is the one that most people know. Sisyphus is cursed to push a boulder up a hill over and over again for eternity. And Zeus says, if the boulder stays at the top, you will be free from your curse. The boulder never stays at the top. And Camus writes
this. But we must imagine Sisyphus happy.
There you go. So I read that, right? I read Camus. And Camus says in The Myth of Sisyphus, we must imagine Sisyphus is happy. No one is so much of a fool to do the same thing over and over again and expect a different outcome. And I said, whoa, I am Sisyphus. And so the way I explore that is in relationship and someone's inability to get over a relationship. And they just play the memories over and over and over again, thinking, what happened? Where did it go wrong? And
this just, I am familiar with.
You know, we all are. We just play them over and over again. And so what does it look like to stop pushing the boulder up the hill over and over and over again? Tantalus. Tantalus was this king who was really loved by the gods. He was really funny, and so they would invite him to dinner with them on Mount Olympus all the time. They would give him everything but godly food and godly drink. And he was like, this is messed up. You keep inviting me here, but you don't give me this. So he stole it, and he brought it back to the people. Zeus doesn't like this. You do not steal from Zeus. So he punishes him to an eternity of hunger and thirst, and he puts him in a pool of water. But every time he reaches for it to drink, it moves out of the way. And he puts these grapes by him. And every time he reaches for them, they go out of the way. And so I compare that Tantalus, that's where we get tantalized from, to be tantalized, from any body of culture who's had been invited to the table but never given the dessert or the wine.
I think I know what you mean. But when you say bodies of culture.
Yeah, I don't like to use bodies of color. I like to use a term bodies of culture, which comes from a beautiful thinker named Rezma Menakem. And we use bodies of culture because whiteness doesn't want our color, actually. It's never wanted our color. What it wants is our culture. We commodify the culture. We make money off the culture. And so I like to say bodies of culture because our wealth is in our culture, not in our color. And so what does it look like to stop reaching for the fruit that was never ours? Narcissist. Narcissist loved his image. He loved his reflection so much he drowned himself in his own reflection, trying to get closer to himself. I make the case that we are all a little narcissistic in order to order from Amazon while the Amazon burns, in order to watch Chef's Table while there is a hungry person outside. In this world, there is a little bit of self-drowning we all have to do on a daily basis in order to move on.
Yeah. Right? And you're an artist who frequently your own personal story is often interwoven into the bigger message that you're telling. Tell me a little bit about that. Why is that important to you?
It's how my heart and brain seem to have met. Like I am a young man who read James Baldwin and my life was changed. You know, I read Eldridge Cleaver and my life was changed. I read these essays of these men speaking about themselves, and yet I saw myself and I saw the world. And that was really impactful to me. I spent a lot of time as a young artist trying to make things that people like and not creating art that I think I even enjoyed. Or could see myself in, or could explore myself in. And I like to think that if I can honestly speak about myself, maybe you will have the courage to see yourself.
So if I'm hearing you right, that the lesson you took from Baldwin and Cleaver is kind of use yourself as a way into a bigger conversation.
100%. I think my show, The Real James Bond, was Dominican. Like I was telling this story about myself, about my father, about this man, Porfirio Rubirosa. And people of all types after the show, I mean, it's not just like Latin people, like white people, old people, young people saying, I pretend too. I do whatever I can to fit in. You know, I know you're not talking about me, but like, I really have always been trying to be accepted. Like I get this message over and over and over again. And to me, that is exactly what it's about. Art is the thing that I truly believe can wake us up, can galvanize us to use our voices.
Tell me a little bit about what you mean by art galvanizing people on a grander scale.
I know what my book has done. I know what my plays have done. I know what even the podcast has done to heal people in a small ways. Like when I get a message that someone says, I've stopped straightening my hair because I listened to this. I broke up with my partner because of this. I get a ton of messages of people, you know, taking the steps to enact change for their own healing, their own joy, their own freedom. And so when I imagine on a larger collective scale, if someone in Arizona comes to see How to Get Free in November, I imagine a room full of people leaving the space different than when they came in, with a little more spaciousness inside them to see their actual place in the world and to see other people. And maybe they care for other people more. And I do believe if you care for someone else a little bit more, if you let someone else into your life a little bit more, that has a ripple effect.
Thank you for sharing that. I feel like that is such a lovely, specific example that doesn't get talked about enough when we talk about the potential for art to create change. I think skeptics of that sometimes look at that as, oh, what? Somebody's going to go see a play or listen to a protest song or something, and then what, call their congressperson? And sure, maybe they'll do that. But it seems to me it's so much more about what you're describing, that someone has a very personal reaction to something that they see in art, and all of a sudden they make a fundamental change.
And art is so cool because if you go to therapy because you want to be happier, you have to be prepared to do the work. But art, man, you can walk into a museum, be bored out of your mind, look at a painting and start crying. And you don't know why. Art can find the cracks in you, in between the armor that you didn't know existed, and make them wider.
Right. It like plucks a string you didn't even know was on your
100%.
Instrument. 100%. Yeah. So you're an artist also who has been doing this kind of work, both personal and political, for a long time. Does it feel different to you to do it in this moment?
Yeah.
And can you give me like a tangible sense of what that difference feels like?
After I wrote Brown Enough, I kind of didn't want to make more work about race and identity. And so I was like, you know what? I'm just going to make art that's not about Latinos being Latinos, but just people being people, right? Mm-hmm. When Harry met Sally, but they just happened to be brown. But we never have to talk about it. And then this political climate has started to shift in a direction where erasure, like I said, is taking place. This literal active erasure towards DEI, towards bodies of culture, towards people of color. And then I think to myself, you know, no, I think this work is really, I do have to keep it about race and identity, because if I don't, they win. Art that is about identity, unrepresented stories, diversity, whatever words you want to use, it doesn't have to be heavy. And I need to make that emphasis as well. Like, to be a revolutionary is also to tell a story of joy. And that's maybe what I'm trying to get at here. It doesn't always have to be woe is me, but yay is us.
Well, Christopher Rivas is an author, an actor, a podcaster, and a storyteller, and an artist in residence in the ASU Gamage residency program. Christopher, thank you for this conversation.
Thanks. It's fun.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Architects in Arizona and other places with extreme heat are working to design their buildings to withstand those temperatures. And while modern technology can give those efforts a big assist, my next guest argues looking to the past can also be helpful. Leilani Marie Labong is a design journalist based in San Francisco. In a piece for Bloomberg headlined What Frank Lloyd Wright Learned from the Desert, she looks at the influence the famed architect and part-time Valley resident continues to have here. She joins me to talk more about this. And Leilani, let's start with the title of your story. Based on your reporting, what exactly did Frank Lloyd Wright learn from the desert?
Well, first of all, okay, so he had this design philosophy called organic architecture. We have to remember that Frank Lloyd Wright came from Wisconsin, which is rolling and supple and green and leafy. And so when he arrived in the desert in 1928, he arrived to consult on the Arizona Biltmore. The desert was really shocking for him, all of the harsh angles. He said that the Arizona landscape was sculpted by wind and water and patterned like a leopard skin. And I think the desert really deepened his idea of organic architecture, which is simply just designing buildings that feel like a natural extension of the land. He is not the first person to design a climate-adapted shelter. That honor goes to the desert's first great architects, the indigenous peoples. And he was, he really admired their innate understanding of place. So what they did was a lot of passive survival-based moves, I guess, like desert masonry, thick walls made of stone that diffused the heat, I guess, passive cooling. He oriented the buildings to catch the breezes. He came up with this idea called the dotted line based on the saguaro cactus. So if you look at a saguaro cactus, it's ridged on the outside that connect, it makes alternating bands of light, shadow, which mm-hmm. is theoretically what we see when we think of a dotted line. So half of the plant is always in a cooling shadow all day long. And he applied that to his architecture as well.
And as you write, he also was very interested in using materials that were from the area in which he was working, right? So like if he was building big stone walls, he wanted to use stone from the desert.
Right. So Taliesin West is probably the clearest example of that. He built it with rocks that were gathered there right on the site, and he embedded those rocks into concrete and made these thick walls of high thermal mass. And I explained probably not very clearly before, but high thermal mass just means using heavy materials like stone or concrete that soak up the heat during the day and slowly release it overnight. Now we're going into summer, so in summer, those walls help keep interiors much cooler during the hottest hours of the day by delaying or softening that heat. But aesthetically, that desert masonry was similar to how he described the mountains of Arizona, which is like a leopard skin.
Hmm. So you mentioned that Wright was not the first person to use, you know, this kind of architecture, that, you know, indigenous people had been doing this for many, many years before this. I'm wondering if you see his legacy after him. Like this certainly seems like something that a lot of architects, both here in Arizona and elsewhere, are looking at in terms of trying to design and build buildings in an increasingly difficult climate.
Yeah, so I talked to Whitney Warman, who is the senior associate at Studio Ma, which is a Phoenix-based architecture firm. And Wright's basic principles are best practices, have long been best practices for sustainable design. And I also want to clarify that the scholars do not think of Wright as a sustainable architect, because that term came much later after his passing. So while his principles are best practices for sustainable design, so that would be, you know, high thermal mass walls and passive cooling and using shade, you know, shade orientation, that kind of thing, I think that the modern technologies would fit into a broader, into his philosophy of organic architecture, and modern architects are incorporating those two things together.
Is there a sense of how consciously Wright was designing his buildings to withstand the summer heat here, as opposed to just sort of, you know, having it sort of blend in and work with the landscape and use native materials? Like, was he concerned about, you know, how these buildings were going to feel when it got to be 100 plus degrees?
Yes. I mean, yes. So I think his best move there was the high thermal mass walls, just making these walls of stone as thick as possible so that they so that the interiors would feel cool. Now, he didn't really have, you know, HVAC to work with.
Yeah.
And but also, like, to have HVAC, you have to have these sealed surfaces so that you're energy efficient with the mechanics, right? And he wanted to be as in touch with the climate as possible. So the best way to do that is to build some really thick walls.
Based on the folks with whom you spoke for this story, did you get the sense that going forward, that architects are going to continue to sort of look back to what Frank Lloyd Wright was doing and try to either adapt that to their particular needs or adjust them in some way, or maybe just flat out use what he used in their building designs?
Absolutely. As I mentioned, his basic principles are best practices for sustainable building today. And modern technologies fit into his philosophy of organic architecture. Yeah.
All right. That is Leilani Marie Labong, a design journalist based in San Francisco. Leilani, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks, Mark.
Tomorrow, the Loft Cinema will be hosting a free outdoor screening of A Star is Born in Sonoyta, Arizona, right where the 1976 version of the film was shot. You may remember the 2018 movie with Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper, but the first movie actually came out in 1937 with Janet Gaynor in the lead role. The 1976 remake stars Barbara Streisand and Kris Kristofferson. It was filmed partly in L.A. and partly in the Arizona desert, including a pivotal scene shot at ASU Sun Devil Stadium with a crowd of nearly 50,000 extras. Viewers can pull up a chair at Empire Ranch in Sonoyta at sunset to watch A Star is Born as part of the historic ranch's classic Western movie series. Watch closely now. And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. A reminder, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter, Radioheads, at tinyurl.com/theshowradioheads. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Chad Snow, our news director. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Thanks again for listening today. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.